In the dark corners of extreme horror literature, few books have stirred as much controversy as Aaron Beauregard's Playground. This unflinching splatterpunk novel has developed a cult following among horror aficionados seeking the most transgressive reading experiences available. Stephen King reportedly threw his copy across the room after reaching the hopscotch scene, later calling it brilliantly disturbing but nearly unreadable in its brutality. The book has been banned in several countries for its graphic depictions of violence against children, yet continues to circulate in underground horror communities as a benchmark for how far the genre can push boundaries. Beauregard, who lives reclusively in the woods with his wife, dog, and deep personal traumas, crafts a narrative that forces readers to confront the most uncomfortable aspects of human depravity while questioning what lines, if any, should remain uncrossed in fiction. On a rainy evening in a deserted playground, Caroline Clark stands watching her emotionless son Donnie sway on a swing, a leather leash connecting them. This disturbing scene catches the attention of Rock Stanley, a massive man who observes them with calculated interest. Though initially disappointed to find only one child, Rock sees potential in securing even this single participant for the twisted scheme he serves. Meanwhile, the Grimley family faces a tempting proposition. Molly Grimley has been approached by a gentle giant offering $3,000 for their children to test an ultra-modern playground. Despite her husband Tom's skepticism about this too-good-to-be-true offer, Molly remains enthusiastic, especially since a $1,000 retainer has already appeared in their account. The brochure from Helping Hearts Charity showcases magnificent play equipment and explains that philanthropist Geraldine Borden plans to build one state-of-the-art playground in New England in 1995. Across town, the Matthews family lives under the tyrannical rule of Greg Matthews, a failed athlete who now projects his ambitions onto his children. He brutally pushes his youngest son, Kip, through baseball drills while dismissing his eldest son, Bobby's skateboarding skills as worthless. Middle son, CJ, watches from his window, escaping into violent comics and music, while straight-A student, Tanya, cleverly manipulates her parents to get what she wants. When the family prepares to visit a playground, CJ sees it as a rare reprieve from his father's relentless pressure. The seemingly benevolent invitation masks something far more sinister. Rock Stanley, we learn, works for the wealthy Geraldine Borden, who berates him mercilessly for approaching a family with only one child instead of finding enough to total nine. Despite his imposing size, Rock cowers before Geraldine's verbal assault, revealing a psychological prison of gold in which he's trapped. Geraldine's obsession with recreating her mother's experience of having nine children drives her twisted plans for the visiting families. The Grimley family, parents Tom and Molly, with children Isaac, Sadie, and Sam, approach a magnificent medieval-style estate perched at the end of a cliff walk. 10-year-old Isaac, intelligent and reserved, endures torment from his sister Sadie, described as a psychological sadist who exploits others' weaknesses. As they reach the imposing gates, they're greeted by an elderly German man through an intercom before being admitted to the grounds. The Matthews family has already arrived, with Greg calculating the athletic potential of his children as they play on the lawn. When the Grimleys park beside them, both families are greeted by an unusual trio. Geraldine Borden, an elderly woman in elegant dark dress and heavy makeup, Adolfo Fuchs, a well-dressed German man smoking a pipe, and Rock Stanley, introduced as her butler, though their relationship is clearly more complex. Geraldine explains her Helping Hearts charity project will help determine the optimal childhood experience and insists on confidentiality about everything they'll see. She shows safety documentation with multiple signatures and mentions they'll be watching their children from a separate spy room. Despite Tom's hesitation, Geraldine increases their payment to $4,000 each. Greg Matthews eagerly agrees, while Tom reluctantly consents after examining the safety documents and seeing his children's excitement. The families follow Geraldine through the opulent estate with its marble floors, aristocratic furnishings, and stunning artwork. In the backyard, they find a football field-sized playground surrounded by black fencing. Though most equipment appears conventional, swings, slides, seesaws, monkey bars, one structure stands out, an enormous green slide in the corner, nearly as tall as the surrounding trees, with no visible steps and a tube that curls multiple times before disappearing directly into the ground. As the excited children rush through the gate, Isaac feels uneasy passing Geraldine, whose artificial smile and sinister laugh are the last things he hears as the black steel gate locks behind him. The parents enter an elevator with Geraldine and Fuchs, heading to the third floor. When Greg comments on the unusual presence of an elevator in a home, Geraldine ominously replies, "You can do anything if you have enough money," a statement that unsettles Tom. The group enters a dimly lit hallway with black wallpaper and proceeds to the spy room, an opulent home theater with three rows of rigid, dentist-like chairs. Fuchs meticulously adjusts each parent's headrest while Geraldine instructs them to participate in a brief meditation exercise, asking them to lean back, close their eyes, and press their heads against the padding. Lacey Matthews, distracted by the slap bracelet her daughter Tanya gave her, drops it and leans forward to retrieve it just as Geraldine pushes a red button. Steel collars suddenly shoot out from the chairs, trapping Tom, Molly, and Greg by their necks. Lacey is impaled through the side of her neck by the collar, blood erupting from her severed jugular and carotid. As Lacey bleeds out, Geraldine coldly remarks that the stupid whore killed herself by not following instructions. In a final cruel gesture, she picks up the bloodied zebra bracelet from the floor and slaps it back onto Lacey's lifeless wrist. Meanwhile, Rock's fury erupts as he confronts Caroline Clark and her leashed son Donnie at the doorstep. Seeing the parallel between Caroline's controlling behavior and Geraldine's dominance triggers something primal in him. When Caroline yanks Donnie's leash, causing the boy to scrape his knee without crying, Rock snaps. He seizes the leash, wraps it around Caroline's neck, and brutally murders her. When his rage subsides, he finds himself atop Caroline's corpse while young Donnie stands unflinching, awaiting whatever comes next. Back in the spy room, Fuchs activates a large screen showing the captive children playing freely. Geraldine returns, announcing the command center is ready, and reveals the horrifying truth. They've entered under false pretenses, and their children will soon be moved from the visible playground to another location, a linear journey with diverse entertainments in each area. When Molly fearfully questions why their children would need their help, Geraldine's ominous tone suggests something far more sinister than a simple playground experience. The children's first true challenge begins when Fuchs announces over the loudspeaker that they must move to the big slide at the back of the playground. As they gather there, Rock appears at the gate with two vicious Dobermans. When a cube-like room opens beside the slide, Fuchs commands the children to enter it. Rock releases the dogs, sending the terrified children rushing inside. Isaac trips and falls behind, and CJ bravely runs back to help him. CJ manages to disable one dog by blinding it with his shirt and throwing it over the fence, breaking its neck. He then blinds the second dog with sand as it attacks Isaac's arm and kicks it in the throat to free his new friend. The boys make it into the cube just as the door closes behind them. Inside the metal cell, CJ tends to Isaac's dog bite wound, using Kip's white undershirt as a makeshift bandage. When Bobby challenges CJ's authority, the other children vote for CJ to lead them. As the cell begins rising higher into the air, the front door eventually opens to reveal a dark slide entrance with a cryptic riddle. After your ride, don't stand too tall. Don't look too hard. Don't look at all. If you want to move on after you fall, just use your ears and have a ball. The children enter the slide one by one, with CJ guiding the emotionless Donnie and going last himself. They land painfully on a floor covered entirely with marbles, their flesh sliced by razor blades embedded in the slide. The space is essentially an oblong cage within stone walls, featuring a ball pit and a neon exit sign at the far end. When baseballs suddenly start firing from machines, CJ realizes they must stay low to avoid being hit. Remembering the sign's cryptic message, they begin crawling through the painful marble-covered floor toward the exit. Upon reaching safety beyond the baseball machines, they discover a macabre ball pit featuring a hanging dummy with an orange dodgeball head, complete with X-marked eyes and a painted grimace. Behind it stands a giant chalkboard with a partially completed hangman puzzle, connecting to the earlier clue about using their ears. Sam, terrified by the hanging man figure, flees down a dark corridor toward what appears to be an exit door, ignoring her sister Sadie's pleas. As she runs, Sam triggers a landmine that blows off her leg below the knee. When Sadie reaches her injured sister, they hear clicking sounds as the corridor's ceiling begins descending. Isaac and CJ rush in to help, dragging Sam toward safety, but Isaac trips. CJ makes the split-second decision to drop Sam and save Isaac instead. As the ceiling crushes Sam, Sadie desperately holds her sister's hand until it tears away from the body. In the control room, Geraldine and Fuchs celebrate their first kill with champagne, watching the children's terror and the parents' anguish on monitors. Fuchs notes this is the farthest any children have made it in their deadly playground. The children remain disoriented from shock as CJ struggles with leadership. Tanya studies the hangman's chalkboard puzzle that reads, "Stab him in the head." CJ decides to help Bobby by retrieving the hangman's clothes for bandages. Despite Tanya's offer to go instead, CJ carefully ascends the narrow platforms toward the hanging dummy. He falls into the ball pit, discovering it's filled with salt that burns his wounded back. Finding a ladder behind the platform, CJ climbs up and cuts down the hangman. Meanwhile, Sadie stabs the hangman dummy repeatedly, screaming, "You killed her!" in vengeful fury over her sister's death. Their moment of crisis is interrupted when Tanya discovers fire ants swarming from the dummy's head. CJ retrieves a plastic bag containing a key and note from the deflated dodgeball head, then kicks the ant-filled head into the ball pit. The children use the key to open a metal passageway in the wall, crawling inside to escape the advancing ants. The children emerge onto a stone platform with a terrifying hopscotch path ahead. The traditional chalk outline, numbered squares 1 through 9, with heaven at the end, stretches between two massive meat grinders that churn relentlessly. Caged cows shriek from barred cells on either side. Beyond the heaven platform stands a door marked Hell, emitting an ominous red glow. A sign contains another ominous rhyme: "Forget throwing stones, just make it across, but losing this game is the ultimate loss. Take a wrong step and become the slop. Learn that heaven and hell are one and the same." Unexpectedly, Silent Donnie darts ahead, successfully crossing to the platform labeled Heaven, but then turns to hop back, a potentially fatal mistake. CJ leaps into action, expertly navigating the hopscotch squares to intercept and carry Donnie to safety. As the ceiling begins descending, the remaining children must cross quickly. Sadie, Tanya, and Isaac make it across, but disaster strikes when Kip is hit by a spray of slaughterhouse gore from above, causing him to fall into the grinders where he's horrifically minced to death before his brother Bobby's eyes. In the control room, Fuchs and Geraldine revel in their success. Geraldine observes the monitors showing both the traumatized parents and the quarreling children. She notes with satisfaction how the group is beginning to fracture after Kip's death, particularly impressed by Tanya's assertiveness despite the horror she witnessed. The next challenge involves deadly swings and spring riders with pendulum axes. All the children manage to navigate safely, though not without close calls. They then face monkey bars covered in slippery grease, suspended over a pit filled with snakes and glass shards. When Molly's voice suddenly comes through a loudspeaker warning them about the greased bars, the children devise a plan to crawl across the top rather than swinging from them. The children discover their next challenge, two massive slides stretching over a black void with circular saw blades protruding through slits in the metal. At the end waits an open elevator door on a lower platform. One by one, Isaac, Donnie, Tanya, and CJ time their descents perfectly and make it safely to the bottom. But Sadie freezes in terror at the top, unable to move. Suddenly, Greg's voice comes over the loudspeaker, encouraging Bobby to use Sadie as a skateboard to avenge Kip's death. Bobby, desperate for his father's approval, stabs Sadie repeatedly in the back, then stands on her body and uses it as a sled down the slide, with her flesh absorbing the saw blade impacts as they descend. When they reach the bottom, Bobby emerges unscathed, while Sadie's body is reduced to unrecognizable human remains. The next challenge is a decrepit merry-go-round suspended over a toxic, bubbling chemical moat. The children must hold on to the rusted bars as it spins increasingly faster, with no clear path to the exit platform. When Isaac's handhold begins to break free, Bobby, encouraged by his father's voice over the loudspeaker, attacks Isaac's fingers with the knife. In a final act of defiance, Isaac grabs Bobby and pulls him into the toxic moat with him. Both boys suffer an excruciating death as the chemicals dissolve their bodies. In the control room, Tom and Molly Grimley are completely devastated by the loss of their son. In stark contrast, Greg shows mere annoyance rather than genuine sorrow, coldly remarking that Bobby took a couple with him at least, as if finding a silver lining in his son's death. CJ and Tanya struggle through a seesaw challenge as their legs burn in flames. They reach 7 cycles, but when CJ passes out, disaster strikes. His unconscious body plummets toward spring coils as Tanya shoots upward. To avoid a propeller blade, she forces her body deeper onto Huck's, causing them to pierce to her bones. Though she survives the blade, the seesaw crashes when the propeller hits CJ's seat. The blade decapitates CJ in 3 gruesome cuts, killing him instantly. As Tanya hangs by one hook with her face and arm roasting in flames, Donnie unexpectedly appears, burning his own hands to free her. Together, they limp toward the golden light at the tunnel's end, both severely injured but alive. They reach a massive rope-climbing structure towering 50 yards high with a golden bell at the top, its central pillar fitted with randomly thrusting retractable spikes. Too injured to climb, Tanya collapses. Donnie arranges blocks to communicate, revealing he can't speak because most of his tongue has been cut off. He offers to climb for them both. Just as he prepares to ascend the deadly structure, Rock's voice crackles through a loudspeaker. "Don't climb it. Just stay where you are. The game's over. I'm gonna let you out." Rock has broken free from Geraldine's psychological control, determined to save Donnie from becoming the diabolical tool he himself became. When Geraldine and Fuchs appear to stop him, Rock attacks despite being shot in the arm. He brutally kills Fuchs by smashing his head into the control panel, causing the Nazi's skull to cave in. The impact releases Tom, Molly, and Greg from their restraints. When Greg attacks Tom and Molly, Rock intervenes, killing Greg by suffocating him. Though bleeding profusely from gunshot wounds, Rock refuses to stop until Geraldine is dead. Molly helps bandage his wounds, discovering the word "mine" branded across his chest, evidence of Geraldine's ownership. Rock confronts Geraldine in her meticulously constructed Hall of Mirrors, a twisted labyrinth designed to disorient and terrify her victims. She waits with a high-powered hunting rifle, confident in her home territory. However, having built the maze himself years ago, Rock intimately knows every hidden passage and false panel behind the mirrors, turning her perceived advantage into a fatal weakness. The mirrors reflect infinite versions of both predator and prey, creating a dizzying kaleidoscope of violence about to unfold. When Geraldine desperately plays her final manipulation, claiming to be his biological mother, Rock's response is swift and merciless. He seizes her by the skull, his massive hands nearly encircling her head, and hurls her through multiple mirrors with devastating force. The shattering glass creates a rainfall of reflective shards as Rock systematically destroys her face, the source of her vanity and power, by smashing it repeatedly into mirrored surfaces. Some of these mirrors are grotesquely adorned with the very implements of torture and sexual abuse that defined Rock's childhood trauma. Blood streams down the remaining intact mirrors as Geraldine, grievously wounded but still clinging to life with inhuman tenacity, attempts one final escape. Rock delivers his coup de grace by impaling her on a massive shard of mirror glass. In a moment of poetic justice, her last living sight is her own mutilated reflection, a fitting end for someone whose narcissism and obsession with appearance masked such profound evil. Despite suffering severe injuries himself, Rock pushes deeper into the playground. His condition deteriorates rapidly, his heart rate becoming erratic, consciousness wavering from blood loss, each step more laborious than the last. Through sheer force of will, he drags himself to the ancient merry-go-round, the site of rare childhood moments of joy amidst years of abuse. Using his remaining strength, he sets the rusty mechanism spinning at a frenzied pace before collapsing onto its center. As he lies there, blood pooling beneath him and mixing with decades of rust, Rock stares up at the perfectly cloudless blue sky. The playground equipment squealing gradually slows with his fading heartbeat. But for the first time in his tortured existence, a genuine smile crosses his face. In these final moments, Rock experiences a profound sense of peace, a feeling of completion, and, paradoxically, freedom through violence. The story's aftermath focuses on the survivors. Tom and Molly, though deeply affected by the events, commit themselves to caring for Tanya and Donnie, the two children who managed to survive Geraldine's reign of terror. Both children bear deep physical and psychological scars, but their survival represents a crucial victory against overwhelming evil. Their ongoing recovery, supported by Tom and Molly's unwavering dedication, suggests that even in the aftermath of unimaginable horror, healing is possible through compassion, sacrifice, and human connection. The cycle of abuse, at least for these survivors, has been definitively broken. At its core, Playground explores the disturbing reflection between childhood innocence and adult depravity. Geraldine's twisted playground serves as a physical manifestation of how adults project their own traumas onto children. Her obsession with her mother, which began with childhood neglect and culminated in matricide, festers into a poisonous legacy. Her inability to have children of her own transforms into a pathological desire to destroy others' offspring, revealing how personal pain can metastasize into societal violence. The playground, traditionally a symbol of childhood joy, laughter, and developmental growth, becomes perverted into an instrument of torture, its familiar equipment reimagined as tools of torment. The novel masterfully juxtaposes different parenting styles through its carefully crafted characters. Greg Matthews embodies the darker side of parental ambition, viewing his children as investments and extensions of himself rather than individuals deserving of autonomy. His toxic masculinity and obsession with athletic achievement manifest in brutal training sessions, emotional manipulation, and psychological abuse that push his sons toward destruction. His character serves as a stark warning about the fine line between motivation and manipulation, ambition and abuse. In contrast, Tom and Molly Grimley, though deeply flawed and sometimes neglectful, demonstrate genuine love for their children. Their ultimate act of selflessness, begging for the lives of children not their own, showcases how true parental love transcends biological bonds. Rock Stanley's character arc provides the novel's most complex exploration of abuse's generational impact. Both victim and perpetrator, his story traces a cycle of violence from his own childhood trauma through to his adult crimes. His relationship with Donnie proves particularly revealing. In The Boy, Rock sees his own lost innocence reflected back at him. His redemption comes not through conventional means, but through recognition and sacrifice, choosing to break the cycle of violence rather than perpetuate it. The merry-go-round where he meets his end becomes a powerful symbol of cyclical violence and escape, his final moments representing a bittersweet return to the childhood innocence he never experienced. Only in death, after ensuring the children's salvation, does he find the peace that eluded him in life. Through its extreme violence and unflinching portrayal of child endangerment, Playground forces readers to confront uncomfortable questions about the vulnerability of children in a world where adults hold absolute power. The novel suggests that true horror lies not in supernatural threats, but in the capacity for human cruelty, particularly when directed at those least able to defend themselves. This theme resonates throughout the narrative in increasingly disturbing ways, from subtle psychological manipulation to outright physical violence. The author's decision to focus on multiple forms of abuse, physical, emotional, and psychological, creates a comprehensive examination of how adult authority can be weaponized against the innocent.